I'm Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. I am not the speaker. I am introducing my friend and comrade, Diana Block. I had the honor of blurbing her new book, which AK Press published. It is out there for sale. She's doing a lot of events, a launch at the Women's Building a week from Sunday, and City Lights the following Thursday. Let me read what I said about this book, blurbing it. I said, Diana Block's Arm the Spirit is a stunning piece of work with pitch-perfect voice and strong writing. She gives voice to many of us who took up the vocation of revolution and who have remained true to the vision of a radically transformed world. I give you Diana Block. Okay. Thank you so much, Roxanne, both for this introduction and for your amazing blurb, which really has helped launch this book. Okay, I'm going to give everybody a couple of minutes to please, either if you want to go to some other event and talk, that's wonderful, just so that the acoustics can work in here, or else, really, I'd be more than happy to have you join this discussion, reading and discussion of my new memoir. Okay, great. So I'm really, really very happy and excited to be here with so many incredible radical writers, readers, and activists. My new memoir, Arm the Spirit, as Roxanne just said, has just been published. The book tells the story of our time underground, and it also explores the political history of the 70s that led to our decision and the time after we returned to public life in 1994, when Claude and another member of our group, Donna, went to prison. I'm going to start by reading from the first chapter, which is called Escape. And then, depending on the time, I'll read a few other excerpts, and then I want to leave time for questions and answers. So I'm going to be looking at my watch to make sure I have time for all of this. And then afterwards, I'll be at the AK table to talk and to sign books. Escape. In hindsight, many dreams seem prophetic. In my sleep, just before Claude woke me, our backyard was exploding. Our carefully planted garden disintegrating into shards of burnt leaves and incinerated flowers. So when Claude shook me out of that nightmare into another, my heart was already racing. It took me a few minutes to register the palm-sized square box with wires extending from its side, which Claude held in one hand. The index finger of his other hand was placed in warning over his mouth. Almost inaudibly, he whispered that he had just found this ugly object while trying to fix the car radio of our green Toyota. The object was a bug, a surveillance device for tracking movement. Dazed but awake now, I looked over on the floor at the right side of my bed. Our two-week-old son, Tony, was sleeping calmly in the handcrafted cradle we had found at a garage sale a month before. He had finally fallen into a deep sleep after a night of restless feedings. Now, as my mind began to assimilate our transformed situation, I longed to return to the questions about the best breastfeeding schedule that Claude and I had been arguing about in the middle of the night. Instead of dealing with the looming issue before us, what were we going to do now that the FBI had found us? While we didn't know how they had found us, a bug in our car could only mean one thing. The FBI had planted a tracking mechanism because they knew who we really were and were watching us to gather more information before arresting us. They weren't interested in the comings and goings of Lynn Foster, the hospital clerk, or Ed James, the short order cook, the underground personas that we had been carefully cultivating for some time. They wanted information on Diana Block, Claude Marx, and the four other people that we were working with in clandestinity, plus anyone else they could ensnare. Fear was rising inside of me, but another glance over at Tony helped click my mental discipline into place. I could not allow myself to dwell on the worst-case scenario. we had to figure out what to do. We knew that our houses were likely to be bugged with other listening devices and watching contraptions, making it impossible to talk freely inside. Within an hour, Claude and I had contacted our four companions and gathered for a faux picnic in our local Van Nuys park. We wanted to act as normal as possible, to behave as if we had found nothing, to buy ourselves time, so that even an observant FBI agent would not realize that we had discovered their bug. Instead, they would think we were merely continuing the strange daily routines that we used to secure our clandestine lives. We constantly met in parks, in coffee shops, or in malls. We spoke in measured voices. We rarely used our home phones, and when we did, it was only to call the movie theater or library, never to communicate with each other. We watched for cars that were watching us, or at least we tried to. While we aspired to discipline technique, in reality, we were novices in clandestine methodology and were easily worn out by the constant pressure of our sometimes arbitrary rules. That June morning, it seemed like all of our past shadowy efforts had been a poor dress rehearsal for this, the real thing. It was June 11, 1985, in Los Angeles's San Fernando Valley, and at 10 a.m., the heat was already building, and the park, with its brownish grass and skimpy sprinklers, was filling with kids. The seven of us, myself, Claude, Donna, Jody, Karen, Rob, and Tony, spread out our pretend hastily compiled picnic on a blanket and took turns walking and jiggling Tony to keep him content, while we all tried to stave off panic and concentrate on the decisions at hand. As I looked around, I absurdly noted how each one of us was gravitating toward his or her typical comfort food. Claude had cornered the bag of tortilla chips. Jody was chomping the raw vegetables. Rob had cut off a huge hunk of Gouda cheese. Donna was nibbling a chocolate bar. Karen hugged the box of Triscuits, and I was gobbling cherries. These people had been my close friends and political comrades for over 10 years, and we had already been in many tough political situations together. But most of those years, we had worked together as public activists. We had never faced the type of cataclysmic decision that was now ominously staring us in the face. Still, the consistency of their food preferences reassured me. I knew them all well enough to trust their instincts beyond food. Usually we debated issues and decisions at great length. We each had our own different ways of coming at problems, and it could take hours before we could hammer out a common approach to a challenge. But this time, there was little argument. We all agreed that the only possible solution was to leave as rapidly as possible with as much normalcy as we could muster. Over the past couple of years, other clandestine groups had been caught because they downplayed possible evidence of entrapment or didn't act decisively enough once they understood that they were compromised. We could not make the same mistakes. Our only hope lay in getting away. Our consensus on this necessity propelled us forward, even though it seemed almost impossible that we could be successful. Although we had never rehearsed a sudden departure like this, we quickly figured out the basics of a getaway plan. The division of our small stash of money, kept expressly for a situation like this, and the framework for communication via public payphones that could take us through the next 2 weeks without the need for further collective discussion. Returning to our house, I put Tony down in his carved cradle, and I began the task of weaving through our accumulated papers in order to burn or dump what we didn't absolutely need to take with us. I wanted to be systematic and reasoned in this process, but my mind kept fixating on scenes of catastrophic capture. So, that's the thank you. That's the very first part, and I think I have time for one more section before I then throw it open for questions and answers. Yes. So I think the next section will fit in the in my little framework. So we left LA, we went to a various number of places, all of which the book tells about. We managed to escape, which was a great victory for us at that point. And we reestablished our lives finally in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that was a couple of years later. So shortly after we moved to Pittsburgh, the Fox Station, it wasn't Fox News at that point, Fox Station launched a new program called America's Most Wanted. And that was really, now we're so used to reality crime shows, it's hard to remember that, or even know that there was a time when they weren't the norm. But this was really one of the first of its kind, which really began taking the whole law and order mentality onto TV and enlisting the support of people behind it. So at that time, Claude and Donna had just been put on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. And so, naturally, when we learned that this crime show was being started, it frightened us. So this is a little bit about that. We saw the trailer one night as we were watching TV after Tony had gone to bed. You can help capture America's Most Wanted. Viewers were encouraged to tune in on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. to be part of a groundbreaking new show designed to track down the country's most notorious fugitives. I looked over at Claude, and I could see the tension tracks creasing his face, that for him, like me, our lives were once again spinning out of control. Next day in the local paper's TV section, we read how Fox TV had contacted John Walsh, a leader in the victims' rights movement since his son's abduction and murder a number of years before, to host this new innovative reality show. The show would feature reenactments of brutal crimes and profiles of known fugitives with the goal of enlisting national audience support in their capture. FBI lists and post office pictures were one thing, but now we were facing the inevitability that our names, our faces, our pictures, and whatever sensationalized facsimile of our story the FBI wanted to invent would be on primetime TV, potentially co-opting neighbors, landlords, co-workers, and acquaintances into a process of spying, identification, and notification of the police. What should we do? What could we do? We anxiously awaited the premiere of the show. The ads in the paper indicated that the first fugitives featured would be a serial rapist, a murderer, and a child molester. We didn't think that the FBI could twist our story into any of those categories, but maybe the advertisements were purposely misleading and we would appear in place of one of the other infamous fugitives. On the other hand, it seemed likely that Fox would want to initiate the series with the most socially abhorrent characters in order to gain sympathy for this new media endeavor and avoid any questions about its larger political agenda. That first Saturday night, we were riveted to our TVs, and what we saw was deeply disturbing, even though we ourselves were not mentioned. Introduced by lurid and insinuating music, we watched in horror as the featured rapist lured women into his den with the utmost callous pleasure and then proceeded to violate them. After the first reenactment, host John Walsh appeared, commenting in a fatherly tone about the crime we had just witnessed, displaying mugshots of the alleged perpetrator, and repeatedly beaming the anonymous hotline number that viewers could call if they thought they knew something, anything, that could lead to the fugitive. "You don't have to be certain," Walsh reassured would-be tipsters. "Anything you have noticed out of the ordinary might help." Then more music, and on to the next scenario where similar hapless victims were stalked and murdered in cold blood before our unbelieving eyes. America's Most Wanted was sucking its viewers into a voyeuristic world of sex and violence while bestowing upon them the mantle of superhero in the righteous battle against the scourge of criminals who were taking over America. The crime reenactments carried a disclaimer of fiction, but they were presented as factual and true, effectively dispensing with the concept of innocent until proven guilty. If the fugitive were caught, it was difficult to imagine how a jury could objectively weigh the true facts if they had been first exposed to America's Most Wanted's accusatory narrative. We had no doubt that sooner or later our story would be featured on the show, as we generically named it. Over the next couple of months, we argued and debated how we could best respond to the inevitable airing of our story. In the end, we decided that acting as normal as possible was the best way we could go. Okay, I kind of cut that short because I realized I was running out of time, but that's the gist of that section. So I guess I want to, at this point, throw it up open to questions. I know this has only given you a little bit of a sense of the book, but probably enough to, I hope, awake your curiosity. So are there questions? Yeah. If we ever ended up on the, yeah. Okay. Yes, we worked in solidarity with the Puerto Rican independence movement for many years, first as public activists, and then we went underground as part of our commitment to that struggle. At the time, there were many clandestine groups that were actually active for the Puerto Rican movement, both on the mainland of the United States and also on the island of Puerto Rico, and the book talks about some of those different groups. And we as white people thought that it was very important to go beyond the public work that we had done and then work in solidarity. And that was actually the basis for how the FBI found us. And I'm not gonna give away the whole story about what that was, but you can read it in the book. When we came back, we actually were able to continue to do certain types of solidarity work with Puerto Rico, which has also been a really important part of our lives since we returned to public life in 1994. The second part of your question was, our story was on America's Most Wanted. And the very interesting thing was that they actually showed a political narrative about our case. And we felt good about that. Somehow they were not able, or they couldn't figure out a way to twist what we had done, which was in fact just express in action solidarity with Puerto Rico. They didn't twist that, and they couldn't criminalize it. I mean, except to say we were criminals. But basically what they did was they showed a whole chronology of the Puerto Rican independence movement. And then they showed demonstrations in San Francisco in solidarity, and it was amazing. I mean, we realized that we were still being featured on national TV, and that was very scary at the time. But the fact that politics had been forced into the framework of this totally disgusting reactionary TV program did give us some satisfaction. So, thank you all. I will be having a launch party next Sunday at the Women's Building from 3 to 5 p.m. I really hope many of you will come to that. That will be a time to celebrate. I will be reading other sections from the book, and we'll have much more time for discussion and Q&A. And as I said, I'll be at the AK table and signing books. I hope that you'll buy some, and thanks again.